afternoon, and welcome to all of you here at the Iowa City Public Library and those joining live stream to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring Dr. Trudy Huskamp-Peterson speaking on the topic of When Archives Meet Authoritarianism. My name is Ayushi Sood, and I am an ICFRC board member and your host for today's program. As a reminder, we plan for this program to go until 1 p.m. Today is our seventh program in our spring 2025 lineup. We are also in the middle of our new four-part series, The Changing Environment, Adaptation, Resilience, and Sustainability, of which today's session is a part. More information about the series is available on our website and on your tables. We are deeply grateful for the long-standing support from our community. Your help has allowed our organization to grow for 41 years. Hosting speaker programs with experts joining us in person and online from across the world. As a small nonprofit, we exist because of the generosity of individuals like you. As we head into 2025, opportunities for nonprofit funding beyond individuals is becoming more difficult as charitable organizations like ours face an uncertain future, especially when focused on uplifting research and stories advocating for marginalized, vulnerable, and international communities. And as an international student myself, I'm deeply grateful to all of you for coming here today and supporting this organization, and I hope you all continue to do so, especially this year. Please consider donating by cash or check with the QR code on our table in the hallway or online to keep our free educational programs available over the next year. ICFRC would like to give a heartfelt thank you today to today's sponsor and partner, the UI Libraries, and of course, the Iowa City Public Library, for providing partnership space and today's food. Thank you both for your support. Our next program, the last in the environment series, will be next Wednesday, 16 April at 6 p.m. here at the Iowa City Public Library. This program is titled Well Earth, Spices and Sustainability in Business and Agriculture. Since 2007, Frontier Co-op's Well Earth program has been the foundation of the co-op's responsible sourcing efforts, fostering long-term relationships with suppliers around the world. In this program, speakers share how the Norway-Iowa-based company ensures the long-term sustainability of its supply chain by investing in their partners and communities at origin to improve their social and environmental impact. Frontier Co-op empowers its suppliers, helping them increase their market share through investment in value-added processing, and in doing so, retain more of that value to support their businesses and communities. Please see our website, icfrc.org, for the rest of this spring's programs. With that, I would now like to introduce our speaker for today. Trudy Huskamp-Peterson is an archival consultant and certified archivist. She holds a PhD in history from the University of Iowa. She spent 24 years with the U.S. National Archives, including more than 2 years as acting archivist of the United States. After retiring from the U.S. government, she was the founding executive director of the Open Society Archives in Budapest, Hungary, and the director of archives and records management for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She is a past president of the International Conference of the Roundtable on Archives and the Society of American Archivists, as well as past chair of the International Council of Archives Human Rights Working Group and chaired the ICA Working Group on a standard for access to archives. Huskamp-Peterson consulted with the Truth Commissions in South Africa and Honduras, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, the Nuclear Claims Tribunal of the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and worked for over 3 years with the Police Archives in Guatemala, training the staff in archival processes. Among her many publications are Final Acts, A Guide to Preserving the Records of Truth Commissions, A Study and Records of 20 Truth Commissions, Temporary Courts, Permanent Records, A Study of the Records of 5 Temporary International Criminal Courts, and Securing Police Archives, containing advice on managing records of police forces from former repressive regimes. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Trudy Huskamp-Peterson.
Okay. Thank you for the kind introduction. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. Thank you for inviting me to be with you and talk a little bit about archives and how authoritarianism affects archives. Now, let me begin by saying that there are authoritarian regimes and authoritarian practices. And authoritarian practices can affect democratic institutions. They can affect what are called illiberal governments. They can affect opposition groups, especially armed opposition groups. What I want to talk about today, and I probably will stray a little because it's hard to keep on exactly authoritarian regimes, but I really want to talk about governments that are themselves authoritarian. So I want to talk about three things. Most of us, when we think about the impact of authoritarianism, think about the destruction of records, images of the Stasi destroying records when they were losing their power in the old East Germany. But the impact on records creation is dramatic, and so I want to spend most of my time talking about records creation. Then we'll talk a little bit about retention and destruction, and a little about external access to records. Now, this is a slide I found in 2022, which tried to think about where are indeed authoritarian regimes. And you can see in the purple, they had a lot of them across the world. The yellow ones are the ones that are kind of illiberal, and the green ones were ones that were not considered authoritarian. But we need to do some definitions here. So I want to first define authoritarianism as I'm going to use it, and then define archives as I'm going to use it, because that's the two nouns that are important to this talk. I like this definition. It's a political scientist named Marlies Glacius who wrote a book out of which I took this. Authoritarianism is a pattern of actions embedded in an organized context, sabotaging accountability to the people over whom a political actor asserts control or their representatives by disabling their access to information and/or disabling their voice. That, I think, is a pretty good definition of what authoritarianism does to the population. Now, as to archives, in the English language, we don't have a way to separate the three parts of the archives as we use the word. First of all, it's the body of records that are determined to have permanent value, as this researcher is using archives. Then it's also an administrative unit that is determined to have the responsibility. This is an old organization chart for the National Archives. So that's the second way we use the word archives. And third, we use it for the building where archives are located. In the English language, it is a perfectly proper sentence to say, I work for the archives, with the archives, in the archives. I work for the institution, with the records, in the building. That's our problem as we talk about archives in the English language. With that as a background, then, let me turn to my first topic, and that is the impact on records creation. I'm going to spend a lot of time on monitoring populations, because that's the big one, I think, then creating false information and inhibiting records creation. Now, as I said, we think of all of these things that the Stasi has done to destroy records. But they also, when they were in their heyday, were creating a huge amount of records, but even more than that, they were giving assistance and training to other countries. We know they helped the Derg in Ethiopia set up a record system. We are pretty sure they helped the North Vietnamese set up their record system. They helped the Ba'ath in Iraq, and there have been some suggestions that they helped the Syrians set it up. So not only did they understand what they wanted to create to monitor populations, but they spread that information around. So let's look at some examples here. One example of monitoring populations is imprisoning people because they have been deemed to be a problem, a dissident, somebody you don't want out in your population. This is El Salvador, and that has been in the news, as we know, recently. But they, in March of 2022, asked the legislature to declare a state of emergency, which the legislature did. And in the next 18 months, less than 2 years, they jailed 1.6% of its population. That's the highest percentage in the world. Now, you say, okay, what does that mean? Think of the records of the jails. Think of the records of the police. Think how this expands. When you triple the rate of people that you imprison, you triple prison records, you triple police records, all of that is records creation that just grows exponentially in an authoritarian regime. Now, let me turn to a different country, Romania. Romania under the communist dictatorship. And it was so controlled that I can remember going to an International Archives meeting where the National Archivist of Romania came in his police uniform. So they really did have control over the archives. But what happened is that in 1967, the Romanian government decided that they wanted to increase the population from 23 million to 30 million. So they passed a law in which all abortion was illegal, all contraception was illegal, and every woman under the age of 45 was expected to have at least 5 children. You can see then how much the increase of fertility happens right there, and then it starts to fall off as people find other ways to get information on contraception or obtain abortions. But what, of course, does this mean? It means you have all those records of births in maternity hospitals. Romania then established a special unit of the police to work in maternity hospitals to make sure that they were indeed doing what they needed. So we have new records of births. We have new records of the police monitoring them. But then we also have this. Look at that maternal mortality rate from 1980 in Romania, 132 per 100,000 live births. And take a look at it. Just in communist countries, look at how that really changes. And so again, what do you have here? You have more records of deaths. You have more records of mortuaries. You have more records of cemeteries. So again, your records are expanding as the authoritarian government changes that practice. And there's one more effect. This is the orphanages, because as families were not able to take care of these children or abandon these children, you had an explosion of orphanages in Romania. And of course, guess what? Records. Enormous records of the children deposited in these awful institutions. So you can sadly say that this particular law did enormous changes in creation of records, and sadly, the Human Rights Watch just put out a notice saying that they saw that Romania today is making it much more difficult for women to obtain information on health care. So we could be seeing some of these kinds of records coming back. Now, monitoring the entire population is also something that we're seeing now with spyware. And this is a Pegasus spyware. It is was developed by an Israeli firm. It has been sold widely. And it allows the user, and we now have, we believe, at least 18 countries officially using it and 36 more reported using it. And what does it all monitor for the whole population? Take a look. That can infect any iPhone or Android and harvest SMS, email, photos, videos, contacts, record calls, WhatsApp chat, your calendar, activate your microphone, activate the camera, collect GPS data. That's what Pegasus can do. And we've got it now being installed in a lot of places in the world. Russia has also exported it to the former SSR. They have exported it to telecoms in East and in the Mideast and in Latin America, we believe. So it's also a surveillance machine. And you can see here, we've really got a big hack and leak operations. It's surveilling the internet and crushing dissent. Let me turn to China. China has a couple of things that are going on that monitor entire populations that I find very interesting. This is what they started in 2020. It is a national genetic panopticon. And their idea is to collect samples from the male population to be able to see what kind of genetic material there is in China and establish a genetic materials database. Of course, we have lack of informed consent, we have lack of privacy, we have people with no control over their use of their DNA, but China is on the way to trying to establish a national genetic panopticon of the population of males. What about females? They have a mandatory prenatal test by a software called Nifty, of all things, N-I-F-T-Y. That has also been sold in 52 countries the last time I checked. And the aim is, again, to collect genetic data for research on traits of population. They then want to put this into their 1,000,001 database of the National Genetic Bank. And the bank is somehow linked also to China's military. So what we're seeing here is that by using two different tools, but the prenatal tool and the look at male genes, and especially important here is the use of that tool in the Uyghur areas of far western China, you can see that we get a panopticon look again at the population, and all those records are being created and held somewhere in the system. Now, one thing you should also know is because this prenatal testing has been shared with all these other countries, we know of a number of cases in which non-Chinese women's test results have turned up in the Chinese database, which, as I said, has access to it by the military. So that's very worrying, that if you have a test that's being run in another country, how does it end up in the Chinese database? Now, there's some equally disturbing ways of going about it, but they aren't quite as insidious as taking your DNA. One is, that's not reflected here, when you are raided, either an NGO is raided or an individual's home is raided, and their records are seized and taken to the government to be used to take a look at who you are or what you're doing. The variation on it that I'm showing in the slide, this is Venezuela, and This is a law that requires NGOs to register with the state any kind of foreign money or foreign assistance they have had. This ultimately will lead to a collapse, typically, because the government will then say, you can't take the foreign money, and the collapse occurs. We saw this in Russia a couple of years ago with the collapse of Memorial, the long-standing NGO in Russia that tried to figure out who was in the gulag, that tried to support human rights activities. And when these institutions then closed down, like Memorial or like the ones in Venezuela, the government seizes those records. So again, it's records creation. They're coming in. They're bringing in those records so that they can control them. They can see who was being supported, what kind of activities were going on, and persecution ensues. Here's another kind of records creation. If you have a dictatorship or a really authoritarian government, you tend to have some facility in there that does hagiography. And we know that dictators love to have things published that they have written or published about them. This is obviously Mao's Little Red Book, but Muammar Gaddafi had the Little Green Book. The dictator of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, published 890 works. Oh, yeah. Okay. One of my favorite stories is Saddam Hussein, who published four novels that were sort of Romana Clays. But the last one he published was as the invasion was happening, and he still got 40,000 copies published. But what it meant is he set up a whole set of people who helped him edit the books and had to publish them and so forth, again, expanding this record of what these dictators have done. Okay. So let me turn to a different kind of records creation, and that's creating false information. And we all know that public relations offices spin. And we always get a little bit of wonder if we're getting the whole story. That's pretty different than creating real fake information. We know as the Ukraine war grinds on that the Kremlin has increased its work in fabricating online stories to discredit. Okay, so we know this goes on current records. We also see, but that's, you know, it's their kind of propaganda as it was. This is a little different. This is a story out of Colombia. And Colombia, in its dictatorship, had a process that was called the false positives. And what it did was, the military would kill somebody, take their ID off, plant fake documents on them, and then count it as a guerrilla being killed. Because that then gave more credit to the unit that was out on patrol because, you know, we got another one of them. And so that was creating false information inside the government, telling your superior false information. Different, really, I think, than telling the public false information. This is lying to yourself. And dictatorships, authoritarians, do it. What happened? Okay, here's another one. This is where you falsify land titles. It's been particularly problematic in Brazil, especially under authoritarian regimes, in which land that is allocated to native populations has indeed been titled for private use. And you see this as a kind of land grabbing. They call it green land grabbing. But it's falsifying the land title in order to have it exploited illegally. And I'm sorry to tell you, but Brazil is not the only country that you see this in. Land title questions are often part of the issues that go into authoritarians. Here's another one. This just happened. You can see it says March 27. And here's fraudulent adoptions. Korea, in its bad years, especially the 70s and 80s, probably sent more children out to be adopted than any place else, though adoptions were also a terrible problem in Guatemala when I was working there. That has largely stopped in both Guatemala and South Korea, but you have all these false records then, because they falsified that it was an orphan. They sometimes falsified names. And as you can see here in this story, the Truth Commission is saying, yes, they did do it in South Korea, and you now have South Korean adoptees in the United States, because we took more South Korean orphans than any other country. We probably also took more Guatemalan children than any other country. But the South Korean adoptees now are very active in trying to go back into South Korea, see if they can figure out who the birth parents are, but the false records, of course, is making that a really difficult problem. Here's another one, again, pretty recent. And this is really strange, but as you may know, Serbia does not like its Albanian population. And so what they came up with was something that's called address passivization. But what it really means is they went into the police database of who lived where, and they erased all the names of the Albanians. So the Albanians then cannot get new identity documents, and without identity documents, they can't vote, they can't hold property titles, and all of these things come because the record has been changed. The record has been falsified. The address has been changed, and that's another records issue. Now, I want to read something to you. Vasily Grossman was a Russian journalist during World War II in some of the worst places where the Russian army fought, or the Soviet army. And in the Khrushchev thaw, he decided to write a novel of the things he couldn't say. He falsely believed that the Khrushchev thaw was going to last. And sadly, he really got punished for the novel. The novel is called Life and Fate. And it's long. It's been compared to War and Peace. It isn't quite that good, I don't think. But if you've never read Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, put it on your list. But this is what he says about false information. He says, the might of the state had constructed a new past. It made the Red Cavalry charge a second time. It dismissed the genuine heroes of long past events and appointed new ones. The state had the power to replay events, to transform figures of granite and bronze, to alter speeches long since delivered, to change the faces in a news photograph. A new history had been written. Even people who had lived through those years had now had to relive them, transformed brave men to cowards, revolutionaries to foreign agents. There's a really interesting book that it may indeed be in the library of the photographs that were taken in the Soviet Union, which have all been altered. And sometimes you can see the original photograph and the altered photograph side by side. And that's part of what Grossman was seeing and saying. So let me move to this. There is also the inhibition of records creation that affects what we know about a previous regime. And China, after the SARS epidemic, created a system, a nationwide system, where anyone who saw the emergence of an infectious disease could tap into that system and take it to a central location where you would begin to understand what was going on. Well, you'd think that would have worked with COVID, right? It didn't. And the question has become, of course, why it didn't. I think that the people who were treating the first COVID patients in China were afraid. They were afraid to tell the bosses in Beijing that we've got one on our hands. The bosses in Beijing finally found out about it when two documents were leaked in China, and reporters got a hold of them, and that's how then the central agency in Beijing knew that they were having this outbreak, even though they had a system in place. I think also that what you find is that people in many parts of a system are afraid to tell people. It's very difficult, as you probably all know, for rape victims to talk to police, and so rape is undercounted almost universally. But you also see that you've got whistleblowers that are afraid. They're afraid to go forward. And so we see a lot of this inhibition of records creation. Here's the official leading the search for thousands of people in Mexico resigned. This is the previous government, the AMLO government in Mexico, because the president said that, oh, no, it can't be that we have 110,000 people missing. That's too high by a third. You got to reduce it by a third. No, it was probably true. I actually know the woman who resigned in this case and is as honest as they come, and she thought the number was still undercounted because, what? People don't tell. They are trying to find out, but they're afraid to go to the police. They have a lack of reporting. They distrust the authorities. I go and say my son is missing. I'm not going to be believed. Why should I bother? And so you have this other impact on records creation. So now let me turn a little bit to records retention or destruction. And as I said, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. First of all, there is, of course, universal practice. This is the professional practice. You would have something like this. I just pulled this. This is Washington State University. It says how long you keep this record, when you destroy them, what goes forward. And that is a normal practice. This is being impeded now by right to be forgotten laws. El Salvador has just published a new law giving the Cybersecurity State Agency, not an archivist, not a historian, not an information specialist, but the Cybersecurity Agency, the right to determine what data, including historical and judicial information, can be erased from all social media, search engines, and journalists' websites. Okay, so here you've got a situation in which you've given the power to somebody who has no business understanding how records work. They would have no idea what this is, but they're going to go in and erase the records anyway. One of the interesting things is when does a regime start to erase records? Here, this is 2018. So here we're looking at a current authoritarian regime ordering the destruction of a past regime's practices and has done it. This is one of my favorites. This was not revealed until 2022, but as the Albanian Hoxha government was collapsing, the secret police knew that they were going to be in trouble. And so they actually got big bread-making machines, you know, the big ones like this, and soaked their documents in water and put them in there to knead them into pulp. And so again, you've got an authoritarian regime, its own records is deleting, not somebody else's. One of the odd things you see also is you sometimes see the destruction of records of a pre-authoritarian regime. And after the change of government, we found out that most of Kwame Nkrumah's personal and professional papers from the time when he was president were apparently destroyed by the following regime. You don't want people to understand that there was once a time at which you had a relatively democratic system. You just get rid of it that way. They call it a void in the evidence there. So let me finish with a little bit on access. There are worldwide access to information laws. I'll show you in a minute. There is impeding access to previous regimes' records. There's questions of access to colonial records, and there are then threats to archivists. This is a reasonably current look at the right to information around the world. Now, you will see that, for example, Russia has a really good one. The whole issue in this picture is how are they implemented? And, of course, having a law is one thing. Implementing it is a whole nother thing. In 2021, which is when I got this data, 124 countries had these kinds of laws. Another 8 had national decrees or regulations. But that means that 70 countries don't. So you impede access to current records. This is a photograph that was taken last autumn after the change of government in Syria. And Syria had had a particularly vicious rule in which for you to get some documents out of the government that you needed, which included, believe it or not, death certificates, records of your academic degree, property records, you had to have a security clearance. So you had to come to the government, pay them, give them all your information in order to get a security clearance to get your own degree documentation. What did it lead to? It led to bribery. It led to black market practices of all kinds. And it led to then this post-regime demand for documents. This happens to be in a former prison where people are looking to try to find records of their families, their loved ones, but it is a problem in Syria that is very serious right now because people want to go in and just start grabbing records, and you really want to preserve them and preserve them in a way that they will be evidence for any kind of court case that might be brought against the previous regime. And something like this doesn't help that. But you can understand when people have been so denied access to documents of their own that this kind of thing does happen. Here's another interesting one. This is, I'm back to El Salvador. I'm sorry, but El Salvador is really in the news and it has all of these really dreadful practices on documentation. And here, El Mazote was a massacre in 1981 where the military killed upwards of 1,000 people in a village called El Mazote. And there have been efforts to try to figure out what really happened and who was responsible. And a case was brought, and a really thoughtful judge said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to appoint 8 people, well-known, serious people, including an academic from California who had spent a lot of time working on El Mazote massacre and on other things in El Salvador, and that they will go to 8 different military archives and they will have the authority to look at the documents. And so on the first day that this group went, The judge went with them to make sure that the military understood that this was an order and they were to allow this group of experts in. And the Ministry of Defense blocked them, and the government stood up for the Ministry of Defense, and you went absolutely nowhere. You do see some access to colonial records being loosened now, and the further we get from them, further relaxation in France to the access to the archives of the Algerian War. You may know the story of the Mau Mau records in England that were finally released because there was a lawsuit brought and the government finally had to admit that they had records of what repression the Mau Mau had suffered in Kenya. And so we're starting to see this. It's a long time in some places after the colonial period, but we're starting to see a lot of those come true. We also see that governments will help other governments if they want by opening records. And the US government under Obama told Argentina, which was then coming out of its dictatorship from the mid-1970s, 80s, that it would provide, that the US would provide to Argentina documents in our files in the government on what had happened during the dictatorship to be able to use them in any kind of legal proceeding. And that has taken a long time. It completed, however, and we provided Argentina 49,000 US government documents that we had been keeping track of the dictatorship in Argentina. So you see that. Governments go back and forth. NGOs also, especially in the US, have used Freedom of Information Act to gain access to US government documents to then provide them to NGOs in another country. The National Security Archive, that private organization in Washington, has spent years getting documents about Chile and the Pinochet regime and providing them to people in Chile. So, here's the final thing I'll say. This is a guy I know as well. He's a Russian archivist, and he released records that were of a group called the Panfilov Guardsmen from World War II, who were set up as heroes. Think of Vasily Grossman again. This group was set up as heroes. The records show they weren't. And this archivist decided he was going to release these World War II era records, which clearly showed that the Panfilov's guardsmen weren't these heroes that they had been built up to be. He then lost his job. He was demoted. He still had a job, but he didn't have anywhere near the power or the status that he had. He released records. They were accurate records. They weren't falsified, and he paid the price for it. So it's not always easy to make the decision that you're going to release these records when you know that there could be consequences. So in conclusion, remember, authoritarianism is disabling access to information or disabling the voice of the population. Access to archives empowers people and combats authoritarian tendencies, I'm convinced. But don't forget, the satellite photo man will be watching you. Thank you very much.
Now we move on to our question and answer portion of the program. And you can raise your hand and I'll bring a microphone to you if you have any questions. And also please know if we are not able to get your question, you can always approach our speaker after the program as well.
Please go ahead if you have any questions.
I can't help but think of the recent determination that the IRS is now going to share information about people who may not be in the United States legally. I know you weren't going to cover authoritarian practices, just regimes, but can you talk a little bit about, you know, I mean, I think you highlighted that kind of information. Maybe talk a little bit about, you know, how government agencies under authoritarian regimes, you know, may sort of act as agents for the authoritarian government, or, you know, implications of those types of practices in the longer term.
It's a hard question. In part because there are so many ways that authoritarian governments can affect who within the government gets to see records, because they have absolute power. Nobody can say no to them. And with supine courts, in most of those cases, there isn't an option of going and saying, no, I don't want this agency to have access to this. You have to assume that it is a monolith. And as I said, I saw the Romanian archivist in his police uniform. So, you know, when you get that kind of linkage, you just know that governments will share any kind of information they've got. Now, let me say one thing about police records, though, and that is I'm convinced that police feel very powerful when they're outside the precinct doors, because they're out in the street and they've got the club, they've got the power. Inside, the police are in a hierarchical situation, often a very strict one, and they don't feel powerful. They got to point up and point down, and they really have to indeed record what they do, because they have been tasked to do this, and if they don't do it, then they're in trouble. And so we see, people always say, well, what about the police records? They're really complete, and they're really complete down at that very granular level, because people don't want to get in trouble for not following an order. I was part of the U.S.-Russia MIA POW Commission from 1992 to 1995, at a time when our relations with Russia were much, much more positive. And I was in a Russian archives in Moscow, and I was trying to figure out how prisoners were transferred across the country. And I said, if you're out in Omsk and you're transferring the prisoner to somebody else, do you record that? And I got this horrified look, and I was told, of course, because I don't want to be the one who lost the prisoner. So I want to make sure that he signs that he got it, and I'm then out of, you know, the loop here for being responsible for keeping control over this prisoner. So you see that in police archives. You see an incredible amount of control because of fear. Now, I was reading a book recently on the Romanian situation, and apparently they went in and did a huge destruction of records in the early 1950s and got rid of a lot of records from that transition period when they were going from the end of World War II into the communist years. And so they got rid of a lot of those. But again, you just see police records having huge amounts of documentation.
My question would be, if you notice these records are being erased, or that there's a turning tide of losing records or records going missing, how do you suggest for non-archivists to support archivists or to try and save these records the best way possible so that they're not lost?
Yeah. First of all, when a database goes offline, that doesn't necessarily mean the data is gone. And if you're worried, for example, in a university, that DEI information is being taken off university websites, talk to the archivists. See if they've captured that website at a typical time in the past, like every X number of years or X number of months, because it will be there. And so I think that one of the things I've noticed is people get really worried when databases go offline or particular parts of data go offline, and you don't know. You don't know if they're saved or not. You don't know if they were supposed to be saved or not. You don't know what the record schedule said about that data. Was that data supposed to be saved or was it not? I applaud all the efforts of people to go and capture websites and that are either in danger of going offline or have had parts removed and continue to make them available. I think that's really an important thing that various groups around the country are doing. I'm sorry, into authoritarian practices, not. I do think that we ought to also always ask the archivists, what do you save? Do I need to panic? Do you already have it? If I come to you, can I see it? Because I think a lot of the things that we're seeing come offline in the federal government are probably being retained in the archival systems of that federal government. The more worrisome, I think, is the use of private phones and private messagings. That is not what you can do by law in the federal system. I have no idea what the Iowa system is, but that's one that it's really important that those laws be enforced, because otherwise we'll never figure out what has happened. It's a form of documentation that we just absolutely have to capture. And the law says we do.
Thank you so much for your presentation. It's been very enlightening and very informative. I know this might blur that line between regimes and practices, but I'm curious for where maybe national authorities have tried to claim access to archives that are not held at the national level. So you've already spoken about police. Would you mind, or do you have other examples about maybe where cities or municipalities have records and the approaches or practices that have been used in order to capture those, or the practices that have been used by municipalities to hold their data private?
I'm not sure I can answer that question because I'm not sure I have the information. Obviously, there is shared information between all levels of government in the United States. And as well, if you are in litigation, there are all kinds of ways that federal attorneys can have access to state and local materials, as you would expect them to do so. In my time at the U.S. National Archives, which now is a long time ago, but there were no occasions in which I can remember holding state or local records in the National Archives. That was absolutely not what we did. We held federal government records. With some exceptions, we did not hold private materials. The big exception is the Presidential Library System, which the National Archives runs, and of course that has a lot of private material donated to it. But the three levels of government in the U.S. really are independent, and I live part of the year in Northwest Iowa at my family farm, and so I went to the county to see what their records practices were. And then I went to the state archives and said, you know, what are you telling the counties? Will you take the county records in? And the answer was no. And so that troubles me, because we now have 99 counties that we're expecting all of them to take care of their own records. And it's one thing if you have a fairly wealthy county. It's another thing if you're in Palo Alto County, where where I live, which, you know, we have 6,000-7,000 people in the whole county. And the idea that you're going to run an archives there, come on, this is really hard. And so I think that Iowa's got to start to rethink, what are we doing to protect the records at a local level? Because the local level, look, that's really important. That's our genealogy. That's where we grew up. That's our schools. That's our churches. That's, you know, the farms on where people like me grew up. It's our land titles. And if we don't start to protect them in Iowa, I don't know what's going to happen. I fear loss. But you have to know that the state of Iowa does not see a responsibility for protecting county and city records. They really do state-level records. And I think that we as citizens ought to be active on that particular score.
Thank you so much for your presentation today. I really appreciated the portions on population records creation and data. I'm wondering, in a world where, as you say, cell phone data and other population related data is so at the fingertips of institutions or regimes, is it a world where we could even see current privacy of records or personal data at even going into the future as realistic that we have private records about population?
I think we're going to have to really rethink our privacy laws. Privacy law in the United States was something that was developed in the 1970s. So before we ever had these kinds of issues come forward. And you should also remember that it's the product of federalism, because the federal privacy law applies to the feds and the state privacy law applies in the states. And so I think they probably all need to be re-looked at in this particular light of these huge panopticon projects. Not that we have one going in the U.S., but we do have a tremendous amount of data. The U.S. government has decided to have not only national security classification, you know, top secret, secret, confidential, but then they have another one that's called personally identifiable information that has different kinds of protections, which only means that you're going to have more trouble getting access to it as a citizen, because they've got another, essentially a classification on it. It was developed, I think, because there was a fear that people were indeed not paying attention to the privacy laws and being careless with private information. And that's an absolute responsibility of archivists. You have to pay attention to privacy issues. You have to pay attention to business information confidentiality. You have to pay attention to investigatory information. Don't think of investigatory information as just the police. You have investigations in religious organizations of the fitness to become a clergyman. You have investigations in universities as to fitness to be a teacher or not. You have all kinds of investigations, and all those need also to be protected. But I do think that the current state of privacy law really needs to be reviewed. I think you're out of time.
Yeah, I think we'll conclude the session here. But I would like to thank Dr. Peterson for such an insightful discussion. So can you please give a hand?
Thank you.